Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com. Hi there, it's 30 days of Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. This is round 17, and today we say happy birthday to F1's newest race winner, George Russell. So let's hear a full interview with George from 2020, his second year in Formula One. This was recorded when he drove for Williams. He talked about first meeting Mercedes boss Toto Wolff and lots more besides. George, it's lovely to have you on the show. Welcome. We're speaking, what is it, a few days after the Hungarian Grand Prix. How are you feeling after that opening triple header?
Thank you. I'm feeling all right, to be honest. Obviously, a little bit drained. I think these opening 3 weeks has had more of an effect on people than they may have expected beforehand. Definitely myself, you know, when I got home on Sunday night, I just sat on the sofa and it just sort of hit me and I laid back and I was like, bloody hell, I'm a little bit knackered after all of this, but really enjoyed it. Enjoyed having the two races back to back in Austria, obviously ending on a pretty positive weekend in Hungary for us. Obviously not the exact outcome we would have wanted on Sunday, but nevertheless, you know, we've got a huge amount of positives to take from these opening three races.
What is it about you and the Hungaroring? Because you're seriously quick there. What was it? We were 0.1 away from Q3 on Saturday.
I mean, this is what the team are telling me. And I replied saying, well, I've actually never put it on pole in my career around the Hungaroring. So I don't know what it is. I think it's just a George Russell-Williams combination seems to go quite well there. You know, our car, everybody knows, has its difficulties. Some people may not know we are actually very slow on the straights because we have a lot of drag with our car. The circuit at Hungary, just, you know, all of the issues we had, the corner characteristics that the car struggles the most at, Hungary didn't have any of them. And it just seems to work well. So, you know, on paper, ahead of the season, Hungary was always going to be our best one. We definitely were punching there. So I think probably the first weekend in Austria was a little bit more of our realistic pace, you know, close to Q2, fighting with the Alphas and the Hasses. That's, I think when things level out, that's where we'll be.
At least in a Formula One sense, I'm going to keep talking about Hungary for a bit longer because I'm reminded of your first test for Mercedes there back in, what was it? It was this time in 2017, wasn't it? And you broke the lap record.
Indeed, yeah.
As you do on your first F1 test.
I think that's the following year, 2018, when we did the lap record. But I've always in the Hungaroring, I've had sort of very good memories. I've always been incredibly quick there. It's been the circuit I've had the most amount of bad luck at, surprisingly. I think it was in Formula 2, I broke down before the race had even started and I couldn't start. In GP3, I broke down on the formation lap and I couldn't start. In Formula 3, I was leading the race and my tyre laminated, and I had to box. So I've always been really quick there, but there's just always been something that has held me back. But I guess, yeah, maybe a factor why I've been strong there the last 2 years has been because I've done 4 days of F1 testing there with Mercedes, and you know, loads and loads of laps in incredibly high speed, and I've just got that flow. And I guess with anything, practice makes perfect, sort of thing.
How vividly do you remember that first test in 17? I'd just love to try and get some memories of the impression the car made on you, the impression the team made on you. And it was also really hot, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, firstly, incredibly hot. I think it was 40 degrees, that test. So going in there as, you know, a young 18-year-old at the time or whatever was definitely incredibly difficult. My first impression I will always remember was I came out the pit lane and I went into turn one on my opening lap, on the install lap, and I just touched the brake. My whole body and my neck jolted forward. I was just not expecting at all the deceleration from the car and just how much grip it had. And those opening laps, you know, my mind just couldn't keep up with it. And it was just unbelievable. It was, you know, two really long, tough days. We were doing a huge amount of laps. I loved it so much. And, you know, it sort of motivated me even more because, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I knew that's how good it was to drive a Formula One car, albeit, you know, it was Mercedes and they are the best team in Formula One and were the best team at the time. So I was incredibly privileged to have that chance. But like I said, it sort of motivated me to say, you know, I want to do this week in, week out, because this is bloody awesome.
Was it a sort of teacher-student relationship in those early days? Or how did they treat you? How did the engineers treat you?
They were very welcoming from the off. I remember the first ever race I went to, they printed about 50 photos of me and Lewis from about 12 years ago, where I had horrifically long hair. Lewis's hair wasn't looking great either. And they just put it all around the office. And that was my welcome into Mercedes back in Azerbaijan 2017. So, you know, from that moment on, I knew that how they would treat me. They're all, you know, a bunch of great guys. I love spending all of that time with them. I learned a huge amount from all of them, and it's really helped me develop through my career from GP3 into Formula 2. And last year, you know, they're there to give me advice even today whenever I need it. So, you know, having them by my side is, I'm incredibly lucky to have.
When did you do the deal to become part of the Mercedes Junior program?
The first conversation goes back to 2015, actually. So it started at Abu Dhabi, end of season testing. I was testing GP3, and my manager, Harry Soden, managed to get hold of Toto Wolff's email address. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to have to email him and send my CV. I didn't really ask for anything. I just wanted to introduce myself. It was late at night in Abu Dhabi. I was quite nervous in sending the email, but I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose here. I sent him the email, you know, hi, I'm George Russell, this is my CV, you know, it'd be great to meet with you one day in the future, et cetera, et cetera. I put my phone away and I woke up the next morning and I saw I had a response from Toto. Not only a response, it was within 20 minutes of receiving my email, he replied saying, thanks for your email, George, it'd be great to meet up. Here's my PA's details, arrange a meeting with him. And I was sat in his office, I think it was 2 months later. So that's where the initial conversation happened. But when I really became sort of a part of Mercedes was following the 2015 season. I'd actually been unofficially the reserve driver for BMW in DTM. I did a rookie test with them and that went incredibly well. And I was on the verge of signing a full-time race seat deal with them.
In the DTM?
In the DTM. So this would have been the end of 2015, start of 2016, but for the drive in 2017. So a year later. So by this point, I had sort of accepted I didn't have any backing to help me get to Formula One. At the time, none of the Formula One teams were overly interested. And I was pretty settled to say, you know, this is DTM. It was a huge salary. It's probably the next best thing to Formula One. And I was committed to going down that route. And I was here at the start of January at my parents' house, ready to sign the contract. One day, I was just laying in the bath and I got a phone call from a French guy called Gwen Lagroux, who was Esteban Ocon's manager and had been signed by Mercedes to head the Young Driver Program. And he said to me, "Hi, George, I knew Gwen for a long time. I've just started working with Mercedes and you're the first guy I want to sign." And that's where it started. So it started all in the bath in, back in 2016. And the conversations were ongoing. I signed a contract at the start of 2016 and officially became a driver at the start of 2017.
George, what an amazing story. I'm racking my brains to think who else in Formula One has sort of inspirational moments in the bath. And I can only think of Gordon Murray, who was the Brabham designer with Bernie Eccleston in the 70s and 80s. And he said all his best ideas came to him in the bath. But George, that's amazing. Did you write any other emails to other Formula One teams, to the Helmut Marko or someone like that at Red Bull? Or
no, Toto was the main one. I did some simulator days with Red Bull actually back in 2012, and you know, at the time I thought potentially there could be an opportunity with Red Bull in the future. For whatever reasons that didn't progress, and I didn't really think much more to it, really.
You were 14 in 2012.
Yeah, exactly. This is going back a long time now. So they had a couple of Carters who they, you know, there was nothing serious there. They just, we did some simulator days and we saw how things were going. And like I said, for whatever reason, that didn't work out. And I just went about doing my own business, continued karting at the time, and moved into Formula 4 and went through the ranks. And here we are today. So like I said, that phone call with Gwen in the bath was a little bit awkward because, as you can imagine, in a bathroom, it's awfully echoey. I think he clocked onto it pretty early what was going on and where I was. But, you know, Gwen's been by my side ever since that day. And, you know, like I say, a lot of this is down to him and him having this faith in me from the beginning.
I'm sure he was getting his orders from higher up the food chain, though. I mean, I'm sure it was coming from Toto, right?
Yeah, well, like I say, I think I'd met Toto prior to that. I met Toto in 2015. And another story actually with Toto was at the Autosport Awards at the end of 2015. So I was there just on a bit of a jolly, the end of the season. I actually had a couple of drinks and I was feeling a little bit cocky maybe, but I was with a few of my other racing mates and I just said, "Oh, I'm just going to wander over and go and chat to Toto." So this was after all of the awards had happened and we were just having a really good chat, and he remembered me from the meeting earlier in the year and discussed about future plans, etc., etc. And as it got to 12 o'clock, one of the bouncers came over to me, directly to me. He said, "Hi, George, I remember you from last year when you won the Autosport Awards, but you're actually too young to be here after 12 o'clock at night." I said, I'm sorry. He said, "Yeah, we've only got a license to allow, you know, under 18s in here until midnight." I said, "I'm sorry, I'm talking to Toto Wolff here. You know, this is my future potentially, and you're depriving me of this opportunity." You know, he might have turned around and offered me the deal there and then. And I was there with a glass of red wine in my hand, getting ushered away by a bouncer, you know, halfway through my conversation with Toto. So fortunately, we had another conversation a couple of months later.
That's brilliant. Well, I mean, what about conversations with Toto recently? Because your stock is very high. You announced last weekend that you're staying at Williams next year. But how confident are you that you'll get to race for Mercedes in Formula One down the line?
I mean, you can never predict what's going to happen in the future. You know, I've got full confidence in Mercedes that they are fully supporting me. They've made that clear from day one. Obviously, a lot of people can think what they want following recent decisions, but like I say, nothing has changed. My relationship with Toto, with the guys at Mercedes, me and Toto had a long, socially distant breakfast together last week, you know, a couple of hours talking about everything. And like I say, I've got full faith in everybody there that I am in their minds. And as long as I perform, they will hopefully give me an opportunity. So like I say, nothing's changed there. There's no bitter or hard feelings from any side. And I'm fully committed to Williams at the moment and just want to continue doing the best job possible.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com. George, do you feel ready? If the call came, do you feel ready for that now? I mean, I'm thinking of one of your former teammates from the junior formulas, Antonio Giovinazzi, when he didn't get the call up by Ferrari and Carlos Sainz did for 2021. He was saying, I don't think I would have been ready. Do you think you're ready for that opportunity?
I think I'm ready, yes. I think, obviously, every driver has confidence in themselves. I feel ready to make the step. I think I would learn, or I would have learned a huge amount from, you know, whoever I would have been teammates with. Obviously, if it were to have been Lewis, you know, he's obviously one of the best ever. And I would have loved to have a chance to drive alongside him to learn as much as I can. But equally, I know, sort of going through my career, looking back when I raced, you know, GP3, I thought I was ready for an F1 seat. And after I finished the following year in F2, I thought, you know, actually last year I wasn't ready and I'm a much better driver today. And then after a year in F2, you know, you look back and every year from then on in, you actually recognize that you're a much better driver today with everything you've learned than you were last year. So I think that today, I think I'm a better driver than I was this time last year. And I'm sure I'll think it again next year, because all these little things you learn as you progress through your career, it helps you to become a better driver. And don't get me wrong, being put in the car next to one of the best drivers ever, who's been in the same car, the same team for 7 years with the same engineers, it would have been a tall order. And like I say, I've got confidence and faith in myself. Who knows how that would have gone, but I believe hopefully, or I may look back in the future and say these things happened for a reason. You know, I'm absolutely grateful for the position I'm in.
You say you get better each year. Do you get faster? I always ponder this thing. Do drivers get faster or do they just get more consistent?
I think you become more complete. I don't think your outright speed changes. I think, you know, over a quali lap, if you've got it, you've got it. If you don't, you don't. The parts I learn is how to deal with other cars on an outlap of a qualifying session. If your tyres are a bit too cold, how you approach turn one if you can't do your perfect outlap. How you treat the tyres during a race stint, how you give the feedback to the engineers to get more out of your car, because there were races last year I led my engineers down the wrong path and made the car worse throughout the weekend. These are things I've learnt from and rectified for this year. So, you know, my speed hasn't changed, or I don't think driver's speed has changed, but I'm probably faster because I know how to deal with all of these certain situations to get the most out of it.
On the subject of Williams then, how confident are you that they're on the road to recovery?
You know, I'm very confident they're on the right tracks now. I think it's been proven over these past three races. We have made strides versus last year. Don't get me wrong, we're not complacent. We don't want to stop here. We want to keep going. But at this point last year, we didn't really have, or after this many races last year, we didn't really have a huge amount of positives to take away from anything. Right now, we can say our car is very quick in a qualifying format. It's not quite there in the race format, but we're in the fight with some more cars, which we weren't last year. And this sport is so difficult. I think every year is an evolution from the year before. And if you start on the right tracks, you just keep evolving, evolving and evolving. And I think that's arguably why Mercedes are just growing that gap at the front, because they were on the right tracks from day one and they can just keep on building and building and building. If you're on the wrong tracks, you have to start from day one again. And it's difficult to catch up with those guys who have been on the right tracks. But I think we're only going to get stronger. I think we're making more progress than our competitors. And I think that can hopefully be the case throughout this year into next.
Let's talk about you more as a driver. Is year two harder than year one? Do you feel the expectation level is higher this year?
As a rookie, you've always got an excuse, which is, I'm a rookie. You know, I can make a mistake because I'm a rookie. That excuse is now gone. And don't get me wrong, I didn't ever look to use that excuse last year because, you know, I want to be the best and there should never be a reason to have an excuse. And if I do make a mistake, I want to sit there and put my hands up. But I guess now, you know, there isn't an excuse. So from that perspective, I guess the expectations are higher. You know, this season's been so incredibly bizarre that any of this we've not really thought about. We've gone into race one with an open mind and they've obviously just come thick and fast. And from my side, I've just been focused on driving as quick as possible. And I don't get a chance to worry about expectations or what people are expecting of my on-track performance because I'm just too focused on getting the most out of myself. And that works quite well for me.
Are you getting more pressure from your teammate this year compared to last year?
There's no doubt Nicholas is a very fast driver. I think he is incredibly underrated. In all of his junior career, he's had very, very strong drivers next to him. Alex Albon, Ollie Rowland, and he's been, you know, on their pace or out-qualifying them sometimes here and there. And sometimes people don't really see this. And no doubt I've really been surprised at his pace in some of these races he's done so far. I think there have been certain reasons, like in Q1 in Austria, he got slightly caught out by the Giovinazzi's yellow flag. I think he had more potential there. He set a really fast lap time in Q1 again in Budapest. We were actually running slightly different things on our car, which we alternated between in the opening three races. So, you know, he's hot on my heels this year and I cannot afford to slip up. So how he compares to Robert, I can't honestly give you a direct comparison, but he will definitely be right on my pace at points, I'm sure.
What did you learn from Robert last year, Robert Kubica?
I honestly learned a huge amount. I think he was so intelligent on the technical side of things. I've never come across somebody as good as him on that side. His memory, which is something a lot of people wouldn't realise, but drivers need to have a good memory when you do a 70-lap race. You need to think back to things that happened on lap one or lap two or whatever. An hour and a half ago, when you're so focused, it's difficult. You know, he could think back and say, when I tested the car in Barcelona in 2017, we did this and this. I think this is what we need now to get the same effect on the car. And I'll be sat there like, blimey, that's quite impressive. And he was never wrong. He was never wrong. Like sometimes with my engineer, I'd be like, just check that because I can't believe that he can remember this like from 2 years ago. And he was right. Like I said, I learned a huge amount. And how he spoke in the debriefs, it taught me that actually, if I want to be a more complete driver, I need to step up on that side of things. So I was very lucky and grateful to have Robert as a teammate.
How did it feel to out-qualify him at every race? Did you expect that?
No, I didn't expect that, to be honest. Obviously, it is a nice stat to have. It probably isn't something I'm going to put on my CV or I'm going to scream and shout about because ultimately, you know, we're here to race, we're here to score points and neither of us are here to fight for last position. So, like I say, I'm not displeased with that stat and I would have been disappointed if it was the other way around, but equally, I'm not going to scream and shout about it.
While we're on the subject of other drivers, just wanted to ask you about a couple more. Alex Albon, you said at the weekend that you've known him for years. When did you first meet? And have you always been mates?
I'd say the first time we met or we were in the same paddock was 2008, I'd like to say. Alex would have been in Carefree, which was the junior category. I was in the cadet category, and he was winning everything at the time. And the time where we sort of really became friends for the first time was in 2011. So Alex was racing in KF1 in Europe, which was the senior category. I was in KF3, and it was me, Alex, and Charles were all teammates that season. So looking back, it felt just normal at the time, but
the dream team.
Yeah, the dream team. There's, you know, obviously a couple of little images dating back to then, obviously like all playing on our iPhones or something. And it was a great time. So that was 2011 where we became friends, and it was probably 2016 or 17 maybe when I moved to Milton Keynes. I lived in Milton Keynes for a year. Alex lives there. And I spent almost every day at his house, and his mum and sisters were making lunch and dinner for me. So it was awfully convenient, but we became really good friends there. And when I actually used to do the Mercedes sim work 2016, if I used to do a back-to-back day, I'd stay at Alex's house overnight before heading back to Brackley the following day. So, you know, that's where we became really good mates. And it's carried on since.
Is it difficult to stay friends with a rival?
There has to be a reason for you to stop being friends. I think, you know, we have obviously been rivals in Formula 2 was our closest year, but we never had an incident on track that caused us not to continue being friends. I think that will stay the same until we're both in a, you know, front running car and we have a crash together or something for the lead or whatever. Even then, I'd like to think our relationship is good enough to sort of shrug off and move on. But I guess with like a Nico and Lewis, if it continuously happens, then it's difficult. But, you know, we're at very different points in our F1 career. You know, he's obviously winning races, being on the podium, and he's at the front. I'm not in that at the moment. So, you know, we don't have any direct competition with one another.
You proved at the weekend that you're a very good friend to Alex, and you came up with a very powerful defence of him.
I mean, I've known Alex for the last, you know, 15 years, been in the same paddock as him. You know, he's one of the best drivers we all race. You know, Max, Charles, all of us will say it. He's always been at the front in everything he's done, and I don't know what the hell is going on, and I feel really, really bad for him because he's being made to look like an idiot, and he's absolutely not, and he's won in everything he's done. So I don't know what's going on, but they need to sort it out for him.
Did you plan to say something, or was that a sort of spur of the moment thing?
No, it was definitely spur of the moment. I mean, I was doing the post-quali interviews, and I walked out of the TV pen with Alex, and, you know, I could just see he was obviously quite down and disappointed, as I guess as anybody would be, you know, in his position going out in Q2. Obviously, he knows he and the car is capable of much more of that. And I do feel bad for him to a certain extent. I think I'm not going to sit here and sort of repeat what I said. And
but he's proper quick, right? You think Alex is proper quick?
Absolutely. Like I said to you, from the moment I heard of Alex's album, he was winning, and he never stopped winning. And all of his karting career, he was always the top guy. You know, he won the European and World Championships in, I think it was 2010. Against Max and a lot of other great drivers at the time. He won everything else he raced in, and he's always been at the front, and you know, you don't just lose that. So like I say, it's arguably it's not my position to say what is or what isn't going on.
I think that's what Max thinks.
Yeah, he is right to a certain extent, but like I say, it was just my natural reaction when I got asked about Alex.
It showed great loyalty, didn't it? But funnily enough, hearing you talk about Alex reminds me of when we had Lando Norris on the show, and he described being in awe of you when you were karting together. I think he said George was the man.
I wouldn't go that far, but I don't know, to be honest. I guess, I mean, when I was sort of in my prime of the cadet category, you know, Lando's a year and a half younger than me, so you know, it's only natural when you are younger and at such a young age, you're not quite on it at the time. So Lando's glory years came 1 or 2 years after. So yeah, I don't know, to be honest. It's quite ironic because at the time I was battling a lot with Lando's brother Ollie in the cadet category, and he was out of the Norris brothers at the time because Ollie was probably 3 years older than Lando, sort of he was the one who we were competing against. So when Lando came to the forefront, we was like, blimey, can you believe Ollie's brother's like at the front now? But obviously we went, then went on to know how good Lando was, and he obviously stayed there from that point onwards.
Let's talk a little bit about karting. Can you remember your first time in a kart?
I can actually.
And the effect it had on you?
I mean, I can vividly remember, you know, when I was driving. I can't honestly sit here and say I got out and said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life and I absolutely love it. I'd been around the kart track my whole life as my older brother Benji used to kart. He's 11 years older than me. I used to go around all of the kart tracks in a little pedal tractor. And I often used to have a water tanker on the back collecting water for the team for the radiators. And also I used to have a little trailer on the back and I used to go around collecting old tyres for a bit of fun that people leave outside of their awnings. And once I came back and with some tyres on the back and my dad was really angry with me. Like, I was almost in tears. George, you've collected somebody's brand new tyres. So this four-year-old kid has wandered into somebody else's awning, collected their brand new set of tyres that's worth like £120. And I've just put them on the back of my trailer and buggered off with them. So they probably thought that was my tactic. So like I say, sort of driving and four wheels has been in my blood. At the age of 7, my dad bought me a go-kart and I went testing every Saturday at Pier 5 for a year until I was old enough to race. And that's where it all started.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
But could you say then that the racing bug actually came from brother Benji?
Absolutely. I mean, without Benji, who knows? I may have found racing anyway, but I was following him from a young age. I mean, my sister did some horse riding, so, you know, I guess I could have been a horse rider as well, but I think I had more excitement.
It's all horsepower, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all horsepower, I guess. So, no, I guess it all came from Benji. I'm very fortunate to have had him above me, older than me, to learn from. Also for my family, I guess, as well, because equally as I go through the ranks and learning how to handle a go-kart and this and that, you know, my parents went through that with Benji, because when I raced, it was just dad and lad. It was none of the teams. My dad was my mechanic. My mum had a notepad writing down all the setups, tyre pressure, sprocket, you know, axle we've got in and everything. And it was just the three of us everywhere we went. And having Benji and the experience my parents had with him, they knew what motorsport was all about. They knew sort of the engine tuners to be with and what was sort of bullshit and what wasn't. And they had none of that. So from all aspects, I was very fortunate to have had Benji to learn from and to really helped my career as a younger kid.
Is Benji even involved in motorsport now?
No, he's not. He's got two kids now, and he's just living his life. He still claims he's the faster Russell.
Of course he does.
He always gives it the big one that he's the faster Russell. And he came to one of the races last year, and that was the first thing he said to Claire, that, oh, I'm the faster Russell. You got the wrong Russell. Claire turned around and said, all right, let's get you on the simulator. So we got him on the simulator at Williams at the start of this year. And he did about 40 laps. He ended up about 3 to 4 seconds off me.
I don't know. Is that good or bad for a first time?
I kind of had him over a little bit because I said to him, right, we normally do Barcelona on the simulator. So get on the PlayStation, learn Barcelona, you know, the rough braking points, how the track goes, et cetera, et cetera. And we got to the sim the next day. And Ben, the simulator guy at Williams, said, all right, so we're going to do Hungary today. So he was on the back foot from the beginning. But yeah, I don't think Claire had too much to worry about. With Benji being quicker than me, that was that's for sure.
George, it's an interesting thing. You're the youngest of three, aren't you?
I am.
And I am intrigued. When you look at the number of professional sportsmen and the number of them who are younger siblings, you can go to Johnny Wilkinson in rugby, Matthew Pinson in rowing, yourself, Jenson Button as well in Formula One. Do you think there's anything in that you as a young kid almost having to learn things faster to keep up with your siblings?
Now you say it, potentially, I think I'd say the biggest factor of that was potentially my parents knowing the sport. You know, my parents had 10 years of experience of motorsport and go-karting before I even, you know, turned a wheel on a racetrack. And I'm sure that helped me massively because, like I said, it was dad and lad. My dad was doing the setups. My mum was writing things down. You know, my dad wouldn't have had a clue what axle to put in or what tyre pressures to do 10 years prior. So I'm sure that was a big factor. But also, I guess, you know, Benji was, you know, a bit of a sort of driver coach and gave me advice when I was younger, how to approach things, how to deal with certain circumstances during a race weekend. So now you say, I guess so, potentially. I guess that competitive nature comes in just naturally, even though I'm so much younger than him, you sort of want to, I guess, outshine them.
Yeah, no, I do think there might be something in it. And look, and so you grew up in Norfolk. Has this always been your home, where I'm zooming you now?
No, it's not been. So I actually grew up on the Fens near a town called Wisbeach. I lived there for the first 16 years of my life. So in the middle of completely nowhere. So it was...
Is that Brundle country?
Ish. I was born in King's Lynn, which is where Martin Brundle lives now. So I spent my first 16 years there. And when I was 18 years old, I moved out to... Well, I moved to Milton Keynes to be close to Mercedes because I was doing a lot of days on the simulator. I think I was doing 50 or 60 days a year on the sim. It might not have been that many, but it was an awful lot of days on the sim. And at the time, it was a 2.5 hour drive to and from Brackley for me. So I thought, you know what? I've signed with Mercedes. I've got to give this my everything. And it will be more convenient for me being closer to Brackley. I'm closer to the team I raced for at the time, which was High Tech in Formula 3. It all just works out a bit better. And I made the move. So, you know, a pretty young age, moving out. And I've been away ever since.
Well, until lockdown.
Until lockdown. So now...
now you've moved back in.
Now I'm back with my parents for lockdown. They've ever since moved. So it's been nice, to be honest.
They've since moved out, have they? We can't get rid of him.
Yeah, I've moved back. They've moved out. So my mum is loving it, bless her. I think, you know, because I'm probably the youngest of three, you know, I've always been sort of the baby in the family and she's always loved looking after me. And the time I moved away, you know, it was difficult for her, I guess, because, you know, that was the end of her, almost her little journey as such. But she's loving me being back, fully looking after me. I can't say I'm too disappointed with it. I mean, it is quite nice having my washing done for me. And no, nevertheless, I feel like it's the responsible thing for me to do at the moment, to be away from London, which is where I usually live, even though obviously cases are going down. I just feel more comfortable being back in my parents' house in the countryside. I've got my own little gym here, so I can just be locked away in between the races and do my thing.
That's brilliant. And other influences on your career? I mean, I suppose heroes, not so much of an influence, but who were your heroes? Did you have any F1 heroes, or indeed outside of motorsport?
I mean, I didn't have a standout F1 hero growing up. As a young kid, I also used to have a little quad bike and had a little Michael Schumacher race suit. At the time when sort of my family were watching Formula One, I was just in the background, not really sure what was going on. And obviously, Michael was winning everything. So I guess as a kid, you always favour either sort of your favourite colour or the one who's winning. So Michael Schumacher, Ferrari and red became my thing. But from then on in, like I say, no standout heroes. I was probably 16 when I learned that Formula One is incredibly difficult to reach. You know, I just presumed as a kid, just win races and you'll be fine and you'll make it. And I quickly learned there is a hell of a lot more that goes with being a Formula One driver than just your speed. And you need to be a very complete driver in all aspects. And I soon learned that. And I wanted to become a more complete driver. And I admired so many things from so many different drivers. And I thought, you know, I want to try and take a bit of everything from everyone. So let's say Lewis's outright speed with Montoya's aggressiveness with, I don't know, JB's dry and track mixed condition skills, and equally his sort of marketing side of things as well. You know, Jensen was always the man in front of the camera in the last 5-10 years of his career, and you know, everybody loved him for that. So I just wanted to become a more complete driver, and I learned that if I did want to make it, I need to start doing more.
Yeah, I mean, I know Juan Pablo well. I wouldn't suggest mirroring him off track. Love him to bits, but
I won't comment on that.
I thought you were going to mention some Williams drivers or something. Because actually, George, interesting, speaking to Claire in Hungary at the weekend, she said, you are as talented as any driver that's gone through the door at Williams. And we're including 7 world champions there. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I mean, you obviously don't rate them because you haven't mentioned them. Well, you mentioned Montoya, yeah.
To be fair, I do find it difficult reacting to, you know, great compliments. I don't like being arrogant and I don't like bigging myself up. I try to do my talking on track, but obviously, you know, Williams have had some incredibly good drivers. And hearing her say something like that, obviously, you know, means a lot to me. I'd like to think it means I'm doing something right, but I just need to, like I say, keep doing my talking on the track and not be complacent, as I think it's very easy in this sport to think you've made it. And, you know, I'm now an F1 driver and that's it. Life's complete. But you're very easy spat out of the other end if you stop performing. And there's been a lot of good drivers who haven't made Formula One, who potentially could have. And a lot of very good drivers who have only lasted a year or two for whatever reason and gone out the other end. So, you know, I don't want to become complacent and I still want to keep pushing myself. You know, every single day I'm in the car to guarantee my spot in this sport.
And how's the relationship with Claire, with Frank even, Frank Williams?
Yeah, the relationship with them is great. You know, I've always had a very good and strong personal relationship with Claire and equally with Frank. You know, whenever I'm in the factory, we see each other, obviously not in recent times with everything that's going on, but always last year. I never realised how funny Frank was. We rarely talk about the racing, but we always have such a laugh. And I probably can't repeat some of the things we speak about, to be honest. I think I need to get permission from Claire to repeat some of the things we speak about, because they are terribly funny. And I'd love to share some of the stories. But Frank is such a great guy. I think people still are inspired by him when he's around the factory. He will always come down to the race bays, you know, go through the engineer's office or the aero department, and just having him around, you know, inspires people and reminds people what this team and the company is all about.
I'm guessing that you excite Frank very much. You must remind him of a young Nigel Mansell and all the other young people he gave that opportunity to. Is there lots of Mansell chat? or not?
We haven't actually spoken about Nigel that much, to be honest. A little bit here and there. But as I said, we actually don't speak about the racing that much, surprisingly. It's just we just always have a great chat with one another. You know, he always asks what I'm up to at the moment, as in, like, where am I off to? I'm off to the simulator, and we'll have a brief chat about that. But the conversation soon gets sidetracked and we're on to other topics.
Well, look, let's talk Silverstone, just to round this off, George. We've got British Grand Prix next weekend. It's going to feel different, no fans. But can I wind the clock back first and just say to you, can you remember your first trip to Silverstone?
I do. My first trip to Silverstone was in 2009. I was stood on the outside of Copse and I just remember the start. I just really remember, I think it was one of the Red Bull guys was leading the race, going through Copse on lap one. The noise was just unbelievable. Deafening back then, absolutely deafening. It felt like the ground was vibrating. You know, it was just such a buzz as a young kid in go-karts at the time. I was doing well, and that was probably the point where I thought, you know what, I want to become a Formula One driver. That it was that year where something sort of clicked in me and said, you know, that is what I want to do, because that is pretty cool.
So it's the noise and the speed, I suppose. Copse is a great place to see it as well.
Absolutely. I think for anybody who hasn't seen an F1 car live, you have to go to Silverstone. You have to stand at the outside of Copse or the outside of Maggots and Becketts and just see the speed the cars go through there, because it's astonishing. And the change of direction, everything about it was unbelievable. And I think even today, it's the cars are just on rails. And we go through Copse at 180 miles an hour almost, flat out. And it's just electric.
How do you feel on the approach to Copse? How do you feel? What are you saying to yourself? Is it?
It depends how good the car's feeling. What I'm saying to myself, if it's feeling nailed, I'm pretty excited. If it's all over the place, I'm like, oh, not this again. So.
But with the wide open expanses of Silverstone, does it feel outrageously quick on the approach to Copse?
Yeah, ridiculous. I mean, that whole section, Copse, Maggots, Becketts, it is unbelievably fast. Just going in there flat out, you know, in the current era of F1 cars, you know, in qualifying, it's easy flat out. I think for half of the race last year, it was flat out for us, which is ridiculous to think. And Maggots and Becketts, you're flat for half of it. And, you know, the top guys in the quickest car, I don't think you're even breaking through there now. So you're not breaking all the way from Luffield all the way around until the last corner. Even Stowe, I think it's just a tiny dab of the brake. So you can't really put it into words, really. It's like being, you know, on the fastest roller coaster of your life, and you're just being chucked around all over the place and incredibly quick. And it just gives you a real buzz to drive. It's something you're excited by, I think. There's a couple of tracks and a couple of corners on the current F1 calendar which you don't get that excitement that you do at a place like Silverstone or Suzuka or Spa.
Is Silverstone the best track in Formula One?
I think it is. I think it's tied with Suzuka. Suzuka was incredible. Obviously, there's a lot of similar traits between the two. I think the thing that makes Suzuka maybe slightly better is the lack of runoff. It's grass and gravel. On a quali lap, when you're giving it everything, you know, to be right on the limit, you're putting your balls on the wall sort of thing. Whereas at a track with a bit of runoff, you know you can still easily make a mistake and you can easily be off into the wall, but there's always that little bit of extra margin if you were to make a mistake. And I think all of the drivers are in agreement with that. So obviously safety is incredibly important, but there's got to be a mid-ground somewhere.
Quite an old school approach.
Yeah, I guess. I think you just feel that within the car. I guess it's like if you're obviously not breaking the speed limit, but if you're on a back road with, you know, tight bends and bushes and you can't see what's around the corner, you're just unsure of what is there. And whereas if you're on a big open dual carriageway or whatever, things are very relaxed.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you get a similar buzz out of Monaco and Baku and help me here? I'm trying to think, maybe Interlagos as well?
Yeah, I would say the main ones are obviously Suzuka, Monaco, Singapore. They're probably the three that you get a real buzz from, because you know that at any moment, if you do make the slightest of mistakes, there are huge consequences. Melbourne as well. Melbourne is one of these circuits that is incredibly cool. I didn't quite appreciate how difficult that was for an opening race last year. Obviously, we've all had the winter off coming into that. Very bumpy, tight, twisty, but equally very fast at points. A very difficult opening circuit. So very gutted I missed it this year, because I was really excited for that.
Really interesting. Do you have a real feel for the history of the sport? Because Silverstone 2 is going to be the 70th anniversary Grand Prix of Formula 1. Are you interested in driving a car from another era? Would that interest you?
I've got a lot of interest in driving Nigel's car from 92. I was very disappointed when I saw Williams were doing a track day. I think it was last year somewhere. I think it was in Jerez. And somehow I didn't hear about it. And they were driving the 92 car. I was like, oh. I'd love to have had the opportunity to drive that. Or from the early 2000s, you know, those cars with the V10s just absolutely screaming, I'm sure were incredible. But absolutely, you know, I think all of the drivers, you know, the history of Formula One, what it's been through, how the sport was 40 years ago or so, when it was, you know, life or death. I was talking about it recently with my trainer when I sat in my little driver room in Hungary, because I had a photo of Keke Rosberg on the wall. Maybe it was Nelson Piquet, maybe. I think it was Nelson Piquet, sorry, from when he won a Grand Prix in the 80s around Hungary. And just looking at the car and thinking, if you went off, you may not be coming back again. And those guys must have been, you know, equally bonkers, but massive respect to them, because every time you jumped in the car, you don't know what's going to happen on your next lap. And you know, equally, obviously, now it's still very dangerous, the sport. And, you know, we've had some horrific incidents over the last few years. But I think the way the sport has progressed is incredible to see.
Do you stop and think a lot about the dangers, or you just push on?
No, I think you push on. I think it's interesting how your body works, really. As soon as you've got the helmet on, everything sort of disappears. And equally, sort of before a race or a quali session, sometimes you can obviously be quite nervous. But as soon as the helmet's on and you drive out the pit lane, everything's disappeared and you're just in your groove and doing your thing. So, yeah, like I say, I don't like to think about the dangers. I don't like to think about some of the horrific incidents that have happened, because, you know, they have happened to people I know closely. And it is awful, but that's most of sport, and we all know it's a dangerous sport.
When you think of karting, it's funny, isn't it? Because I feel Formula One is one of the safest places to go. Well, not just racing, almost anywhere, any road, anywhere in the world. Formula One now is so safe. Yet you guys go karting a lot still, don't you? Which is probably almost the least safe in a way, isn't it? How do you reflect on karting? Do you still use karting as part of your training?
I loved my days in karting. It was so pure. So much fun, just simpler. It was just a simpler time when, you know, after a session, there was sort of no debriefs, no analysis or any of that, because it wasn't a hobby. But, you know, at the time, karting, you know, I think now things are much more professional there. But I would finish a session and I'd go and jump and play in a cardboard box with a couple of my mates when I was like 8 years old or whatever, or in the later years, you know, run off to somebody else's awning and play a game on the iPhone or whatever. So, you know, things were just different back then, and we had so much fun. And as I said, it was just great racing, so many laps, and I loved my time there. And I still jump in carts today, and I still love it. The only thing I don't love is I always end up with massive bruises on my hips and ribs after any day. It feels like I've been beaten up by Mike Tyson or someone after a day at a go-kart now. So George,
that's interesting, because Senna said that his most enjoyable time in motorsport was karting, because I think he used the same word as you, pure, the purity of it.
It was just so pure. And like I said, it was just simple. I guess footballers could say, you know, going to your local pitch and having a kick around with your mates is, you know, similar for us jumping in a go-kart and having a bit of fun. And even today, jumping in a rental cart, even when I go with like Alex and a couple of the other guys who we're obviously professional drivers, we are just, you know, dying with laughter when we drive these things, because it's just so much fun. So I guess with anything, when things are more relaxed, you always have a bit more fun. But then as soon as you get to a track and it's dead serious and you're there to do a job, obviously we have a lot of fun, which I think is important. I think, you know, we're away for 21 weekends a year in a normal season. If you can't have a bit of fun along the way, you know, you're going to really struggle. And I think enjoying your time, having good fun, socializing with sort of your friends around the paddock or with your engineers and your mechanics, you know, it's so important for everybody's morale. And I think that's what makes Formula One so great.
It's like a second family, isn't it? Do you do much sim racing? We got a weekend off this weekend. Are you going to be sim racing just to keep yourself sharp? Or
I won't be sim racing this week. No, I've got other plans. I mean, I really enjoyed those couple of months in lockdown when we did all of the sim racing, the virtual racing, the competitiveness, everything about it. I just enjoyed it, and it was good fun. It was a good laugh with the guys.
Alex said you only won because you practiced more than anyone else.
Yeah, well, obviously he's got all the excuses, hasn't he? So, but he's probably true to a certain extent. I mean, if you want to do well, you've got to practice, haven't you? Practice makes perfect.
Be honest, George, did that sim racing help prepare you for the season starting for real, or was it just a bit of fun?
I definitely don't think it hurt, because we all said it. We all did a lot of practice. But when it came to qualifying in the sim racing, we all were nervous. And it's incredible. You know, this is just a computer game, just a bit of fun. Yet I think because we all put so much practice in, when you've only got those 15-minute qualifying sessions, you're like, oh my God, you know, I've only got two or three laps to do the business now. And that's the same in reality. We fly across the world, we put all this preparation, all this practice in. But when it comes to qualifying, you've only got one lap in Q1 to do the job. Generally, you've only got one lap in Q2 to do the job as well. So you think you put weeks and weeks and weeks of preparation in, hours of traveling around the world for 90 seconds that will make or break your weekend. And that's, when you think of it like that, that's quite a lot of pressure on your shoulders when you leave the pit lane to do the business. And I guess doing that virtual racing just helped me keep in that rhythm of, right, this is quality. I know I can do the job, but I've got to do it when it counts. And that helped me just to keep in the groove.
Two things. One is you thrive on that pressure, don't you? Isn't that one of the reasons you're a racing driver?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I knew Hungary was going to be a strong qualifying for us. And I was so excited before qualifying. You know, I was absolutely buzzing. But, you know, when you go into the garage and all the boys are like, right, Q2 today, are we doing? I was like, let's see. But, you know, I was so excited for it, just to go out there, throw the car around. And I guess I thrive on that pressure. But, you know, equally, you know, one little slip up and you're here at a zero sort of thing. So it is difficult. You can't get too carried away and too cocky with yourself. And I think it's important not to try and overachieve. I think try and do something that you wouldn't do naturally. I know what, if things are all stable, what we can do as a team and what we're capable of, there's no point trying to push it even further, because I know that if I do go over the step, you're going to lose it. We do all these laps of practice and you never go, you know, 5%, you don't push 5% harder. So I've sort of got the philosophy, well, you know, I can do the job in practice or whatever. You don't need to change your approach. You know, I don't think Roger Federer changes his approach when he's in a final versus the quarterfinals or whatever. You know, you just got to just keep on doing your thing. And I think that's actually very difficult to do. Just remind myself, just go out there, just do your thing. You know, you don't need to do more or less, you know, just do your thing, because I know what we can achieve by just being at the level, and that is, you know, 99.9%.
Roger Federer, by the way, another younger sibling.
Is he? There we go.
Look, final thoughts is that another thing on that sim racing that was wonderful for us to see was the relationship you have with the likes of Alex, with Charles Leclerc. It felt very real, the banter and the friendship.
Absolutely. I think often a lot of our personalities are hidden behind the camera because it's difficult. I've had bad experiences with press where I would say something and it would be twisted into a headline that was not intended whatsoever. So when I approach my next interview, I'm like, well, I've got to be so reserved here, because last time I said something just natural and it was twisted into something completely out of context and made me look a bit of an idiot. It didn't, you know, the team potentially didn't appreciate it. And, you know, equally with what I said about Alex at the weekend, you know, next thing there's headlines that potentially make it look like I'm slating Alex, which was not the intention whatsoever. So that is why a lot of drivers come across as mundane or vanilla, because we can't afford to have that, which is just such a shame, because we want to express our true feelings. Yet this sim racing gave us the perfect opportunity to do this, because we've got the webcam on, people are watching us, we can be ourselves for a couple of hours, have a laugh with each other. That gave people the opportunity to see our true colours, our true personality. And I really enjoyed that, to be honest, just to be able to get my personality across and who I am across, because in all truthfulness, it's been something I've struggled with in the last 18 months to find that line to show people, you know, my true self without coming across arrogant or coming across in a way that people can twist into a certain headline, or
without exposing yourself, really, I suppose.
And exactly, and without exposing myself. So it's been such a great platform for us to show that. And yeah, we had a lot of fun along the way.
Do you think it would work if you were able to talk to the other drivers in a race?
Well,
now I know that sounds ridiculous, but in a real race, do you think that would work? Because it'd be a brilliant TV spectacle.
It doesn't sound ridiculous, because I thought about it. I mean, we had so much fun and banter when we were racing for fun and banter. But as soon as we got to the virtual professional Grand Prix, you know, we were dead serious. And, you know, I wasn't listening to their intercom. They wasn't listening to mine. And we were focused on the job. And because it was competitive, we were competitive. And if somebody did something a bit out of order, a bit wrong, I think like when Lando crashed into Charles's brother, Charles's reaction wasn't quite the same as what it would have been a couple of weeks before when we were doing it for fun, which is only natural. I think probably the biggest thing I thought F1 could take away from that is somehow try and show our faces moving forward when we drive, because obviously...
How are we going to do that, though?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, we've got IndyCar, which has obviously got the aero screen. This is something like I don't know how they could do it, like I say, but I do think being able to see the driver's facial expressions, how they're reacting when they're fighting.
That look of concentration, it's almost quite intimidating looking at you guys.
It's like when we see those onboards from, you know, 2010 or wherever, when Sebastian Vettel was on like a quali lap in Abu Dhabi, it was at night, he had a clear visor on and you can see the look of concentration on his eyes. You know, that was awesome and people love that. You know, we obviously can't wear a clear visor everywhere because the sun's too bright. So,
how much spare bandwidth do you have in the car to be able to talk to a rival, for example? Or are you constantly talking to the team? How often do you talk to the team on the radio? Is it every lap?
Yeah, it's every lap. I talk to the team. I'd like to think I've got a bit of spare bandwidth. It depends the circumstance you're in. If you're under pressure from a guy behind or attacking the guy ahead, or you're managing tyres, brakes, engine temperatures, you know, you're doing everything you can just to focus on your job. But if things start to get a bit settled down, I remember when I used to race in the junior formulas, my dad used to go and stand around the track to watch. And I don't know why, but I went through a phase of like spotting him on the track. It wasn't distracting me. Obviously, back then, you only had to focus on driving flat out. And I was just quite relaxed and... you're managing to do it like subconsciously almost, I guess. it's actually something me and my trainer try and practice a lot on the sim. We do sort of maths games while I'm driving on the sim, or number games. So I'll try and count down from 100, count down from 100 to 0 in threes while driving flat out. And you end up finding yourself just driving without realizing. You're just doing everything subconsciously.
Is that because you visualize a lap before you leave the pits?
No, I'm definitely not one of those guys to sit there, eyes closed, visualizing a lap. Again, I've got the sort of mentality that every time on track, it's different. The temperature's different. Fuel load might be different. The tires are different. If you've got a car 3 seconds ahead or 6 seconds ahead, that's different. The wind has a massive effect. You know, the wind is never the same. So I went through, it was probably the toughest year of my career, 2015. And I did so much preparation that year, watched over every single video possible, every piece of data, writing things down about how the previous year driver approached a certain corner. And every time I entered the track, I had a preconceived idea of how I had to drive. And I was becoming almost like a robot, trying to force myself to drive how he drove. And it just didn't work for me. And the following year, I just said, right, I'm forgetting all of that. I'm just going to go out. I'm just going to drive as quick as I can. And I ended up doing things that my teammates at the time thought I was having them over, because they would ask me questions like, why are you doing this in that corner? And I said, well, I don't really know, to be honest. And I said, what do you mean you don't know? It's just, well, you know, I had a bit of oversteer, so you went on the throttle a little bit, or a bit of understeer, so I held the brakes and I did this. And it just sort of all happened naturally. And I think that was a real turning point in my career in single seaters, when I just let it flow. And I knew what I had to do in certain circumstances, and I was always ready to adapt and not have any major preconceived ideas how to approach a corner or a lap.
It's all instinctive, and I'm sure that's why you're so good in the wet.
Yeah. I mean, I'll let you comment on that. And I would just nod, but obviously this is a podcast nodding. So,
but we've seen proof of that, haven't we?
Yeah, I don't know.
Fascinating, George. That's absolutely fascinating. Well, look, I think everyone listening to this will agree with me when we say, look, we really hope that Williams get it together, and next year, you know, you're going to be up there. I was going to say fighting with your friend Charles Leclerc, but you're almost doing that now. But getting closer to the front. And when we do another one of these in a few years' time, we're talking about wins and poles and all those things that you deserve. George, great to chat to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. No, it's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed hearing that archive chat with a young pre-Mercedes George Russell. He appeared on the show last year as well, and there's a link to that episode in the description for this one. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with another highlight from the huge Beyond the Grid back catalogue.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun. From the racetrack to your driveway, Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.